Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'd like to thank you for tuning in to VisionWorks. My name is Claire Lyons Devon, and I am the host of VisionWorks. VisionWorks is an opportunity for people to share how they are living and implementing their vision in the community and around the world. VisionWorks airs every third Sunday on the International Black Summit Talk Show Network. For those of you who are new to the International Black Summit Talk Show Network, we broadcast every Sunday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and also the second and fourth Tuesday evening at 6:30 p.m. I'd like to take a moment to share with you and tell you a little bit about who we are. The International Black Summit is a gathering of people of Black African descent from diverse backgrounds, countries, lifestyles, opinions, and views, and we come together to celebrate and empower the vision of the International Black Summit Declaration. We also explore questions and issues which empower participants to realize their vision for the Black community and the world. You're invited to join us this year as we gather in London, England, the first weekend in August, July 3rd through August the 2nd. If you'd like to register for our annual event, you can go to our website at www.blacksummit.org. And participants around the world have found this to be an empowering event that fosters personal breakthroughs, it energizes relationships, and really provides for community transformation. I'd like to take a moment to share with you the declaration of the International Black Summit. We declare ourselves, our community, and all communities whole and complete. There is nothing to do except be. We assert that we are responsible for generating community as possibility and distinction. We listen for and grant being to the possibility and creation of unpredictable results. Our conversation of, about, and for those of African descent is one of power, self-generation, abundance, responsibility, unity, and integrity with the possibility of being. We stand for the expression of our spirituality, ending the murders of our men, women, and children, building economies responsible for funding our community, maintaining wellness of being in our body, providing human services, establishing nurturing relationships, altering the conversation of who we are in the media, empowering our youth. We declare that our community manifests itself in the world as a contribution in the transformation of the universe. And this declaration statement was first created at the formal summit event in Atlanta, Georgia in 1991, and it continues to presence itself today in this moment in me, in our guests, and all over the world. VisionWorks, the show, came up as an idea to allow for the public expression of the many contributions at work that reflect the manifestation of this declaration. This month, we will be focusing on several phases of the International Black Summit Declaration, providing human services and empowering our youth. We recently celebrated Mother's Day, and we'll be celebrating Father's Day next month. And I'd like to go out on a limb and say that most parents may not think of raising their children as providing a human service or as empowering our youth. Well, I want to acknowledge all parents for providing the number one human service, that of caring for and guiding our children. This service is provided with no pay and a lot of times little acknowledgement or even gratitude. But it is the one service that genuinely reflects how we show up as the human race. Tonight we have some very special guests who will be sharing about services that are available to parents. And for this show, we're going to focus on single parents. We also have an opportunity to hear about a very unique and special mentoring project, and we'll get some valuable insight into foster parenting. I'd like to welcome Ms. Roslyn Daniel and Ms. Linda Crenshaw. These folks are truly living their vision and demonstrating providing human services and empowering our youth. Welcome to VisionWorks. How are you doing, ladies?
Thank you.
We're doing fine. I am.
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me, and welcome, my fellow guest.
Thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful. I'd like to also welcome and thank everyone who is listening live tonight and the folks in the chat room. If you'd like to share a comment or if you have any questions, the call-in number is 646-716-9827. You can also access the show via the web at www.blacksummit.org/talkshow. So we're going to start with Miss Daniel, one of our guests tonight, who is truly living her vision. And basically both in your professional and your personal life, you're reflecting these two powerful points of the IBS Declaration. If you could, you know, take a minute and tell our audience a little bit about yourself and what you're doing.
Well, thank you again. Again, my name is Rosalyn Daniel. I've been an employee with the State of New Jersey's Division of Youth and Family Services for a little more than 12 years now. I've served in various capacities, but I'm currently serving as a case practice specialist. And this has been an ironic journey for me because I, along with my 8 siblings, grew up in foster care and were adopted through the division and have gone on to success in various aspects. But in particular, for me, I find myself really finding the declaration resonating within me even as you spoke it, Clara, because that's absolutely one of the goals I have as a case practice specialist, to empower the families and the women and children and fathers that I work with information, with knowledge, with an understanding that we have endless possibilities. The only thing that's missing between the vision that we have in our heart and the execution is information, which is why I believe my role is pivotal within our agency. So thank you for having me.
I appreciate you coming on the show. And you shared something that I didn't know. I didn't realize that you came out of the foster parenting community. Ms. Crenshaw is a phenomenal, phenomenal woman and a phenomenal, phenomenal foster parent.
Mm.
And, yeah, and I'm really proud of her, not only for the work that she's doing in that environment, but she's also a very dear friend of mine. So I appreciate you coming on the show as well, Ms. Crenshaw.
Thank you,
Ms. Crenshaw.
Thank you very much.
Yes. So, Ms. Daniel, share a little bit more about some of the services that are available through your organization.
Well, the division offers, as Ms. Crenshaw would know, a variety of supportive services, in particular for foster parents. New Jersey Foster Care, in particular, where there's been such a significant need for adoption, particularly for our older children, adolescents. We have the Foster Parent Support Organization, of course. We have the Foster and Adoptive Family Services Organization. And I did a little research because I like to give the providers that we have a little more than just the website information. There's so much support that we can tap into through fosterparentnet.org, which helps provide supportive services. They have chat rooms, they have groups, they have resources, guidance, kind of like your 411 website for foster parents. They have groups which meet regularly, and Ms. Crenshaw might know about the foster parents, you know, the National Foster Parent Association, which is very active, and there is a chapter in every county in the state of New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
I strongly advocate we have Pride training for prospective, which we now call resource parents. We provide significant 27 hours of training for prospective parents. It's called Pride training. And, we really, in particular in Camden County, Camden City in particular where I work, we really make an effort to do more than just give them the curriculum. We really like to celebrate them. Our resource support units have been put in place to support resource parents. And you know, I try to, I believe what's unique about what's going on in our agency now is as a result of the reform plan, which is being implemented through the Division of Youth and Family Services, we've got a lot of federal funding, which provides for unique services. For example, we have resource parents who might, you know, without grants or funds, be able to provide additional housing or provide resources for their children, whereas now the division offers small grants and loans to assist parents whose homes would not be licensed to obtain licensing through the Office of Licensing. I mean, there's grant programs now. There's a lot of community education going on. There's a lot of community outreach, which is being done by our resource development specialists. And there's even support for single parents, of which I'm one. You know, there's a lot of information through singleparentcentral.com, which also deals with foster parenting, single mothers, single fathers, ways to meet other people in your community. So there is a lot that the division offers, which is also you can locate through the www.state.nj.us/DCF website. Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you. And there's behavioral health supports because a lot of our children that are coming into care now have special needs. And through the DCF website, there's behavioral health support. If you call the 1-877-NJ-ABUSE phone number, you're also connected to a community-based entity, which is called Differential Response. And this is a stopgap measure that tries to prevent children who are living in family, you know, who may live with families, single parents otherwise, the families are in distress. It's a step below DIFAS intervention, and it's local within each county. And if you call the 877-NJ-ABUSE phone number, and they would screen your crisis or screen your situation, and they would determine whether or not it's appropriate, you know, whether or not your level of service or level of crisis warrants, you know, DIFAS or differential response assistance, and then they would funnel you directly to a differential response agency, which I think is unique in that every case does not warrant DIFAS involvement. Every family simply needs support and help, and that help can take many forms, and I like that the centralized screening is now equipped to funnel divert families as needed to other entities, community-based services that I think have been helpful in preventing or I think decreasing the number of DIFAS referrals that we've received recently. So I also like to encourage people to use that toll-free number to access the differential response community support services, which also includes the Division of Child Behavioral Health and the value options number, which is the mental health component of the division, which actually works to help families access critical care or different behavioral health services for youth and adolescents who might be experiencing some difficulties in mainstream education, socially and otherwise. It's a screening tool that wherein they determine the level of care that your child might need. So I think Value Options is also an excellent resource, which can also be accessed through the NJ Abuse number.
Gotcha. Ms. Crenshaw, I see that you'd like to make a comment. I have a couple of clarification questions for you, though, Ms. Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
One is if you could kind of break down what DIFAS is for our listening audience.
Oh, okay. You know, I'm so sorry. DIFAS is a state-mandated child protective service agency. Its goal, of course, is to foster the permanency, the safety, and the well-being of children and families. And this goal is met through a multi-level approach, which involves conducting safety and risk assessments. You usually get involved with the division usually based upon an allegation of abuse or neglect, which, again, by calling the 1-877-NJ-ABUSE number, any person who suspects that abuse or neglect is occurring with a child in regular or foster care, they can call this that 1-877-NJ-ABUSE phone number, at which point their concerns will be screened by a screener, and then the level of intervention, whether it be an immediate intervention or a 24-hour intervention, would be determined. So we are a child protective agency mandated by New Jersey statutes, Title IX and Title 30, to investigate all allegations of abuse or neglect and to provide services commensurate with the needs that a family would present. And as Ms. Crenshaw would know, some of those needs that families present, wherein, you know, if it's determined that their children are not safe, some of those services do include foster, or now as it's called, resource care, and or adoption services through adoptive or pre-adoptive homes, adolescent services, Division of Child Behavioral Health Services, and again, even if an investigation determines that DIFAS intervention is not warranted, we also include the differential response as a component, or as an organization that's under the umbrella of the Division of Youth and Family Services that can be accessed for families whose children are safe, you know, whose well-being may be in question, but who need some kind of community-based assistance.
Gotcha.
Does that answer the DIFAS question?
It does.
It does.
And then the other question I had for clarification, the services that you talked about, can any parent call the agency for those services, or is it earmarked for a particular type of situation, you know, i.e.?
Okay, yes, let me clarify that. The Division of Youth and Family Services is a child protective and child welfare agency. And
okay.
Child protection involves allegations of abuse or neglect. Child welfare, however, involves issues where the permanency and well-being of a child could be compromised. For example, you may have an adolescent in a home, in his or her natural home, who, as I said before, may have a mental health disorder or it's undiagnosed, or they're having some challenges, a situational crisis could happen in the family. There could be family stressors, divorce, so many issues that affect families today that the family says our kid is at risk of harming himself or others, for example. They can still call the 1-877-NJ-ABUSE phone number. It may be the case, however, that because it's simply a child welfare issue, that they're advised that, well, this referral or this information you're providing to the screener that you will encounter when you call that a number doesn't rise to the level of abuse or neglect. Therefore, we're going to give you the phone number for differential response. Differential response being the community-based intervention for all families, whether they are involved with the division or not. And this is the agency that provides supportive services. They have emergency cash grants, which are to be provided to families. For example, you may have a family who, you know, who may not have electric. You know, maybe their bill was past due and their electric was turned off, but they have an infant in the child, or they have a child with special needs. And because they don't have electric, were they not to receive some kind of emergency assistance, which differential response and other emergency service agencies can provide, then you might be looking at a child going into temporary resource care simply because that family simply cannot provide meet the physical needs of that child through having electric. So that's why I say the division. I tell everyone, you know, you can call the 1-877-NJ-ABUSE number, even if you're diverted to the differential response resource in your community, or you suspect abuse or neglect, or you know that there's a family in crisis. When you call the screening number, they also have the Family Support Organization phone number, which provides for families that are in crisis. And then they have the differential response, which is an in-home intervention service that will come out. They'll screen the crisis. Parents can call this number themselves. Therefore, it's not a DIFAS service, if you will, so that the stigma of people not wanting to have anything to do with the Division of Youth and Family Services. Differential Response is not a DIFAS service. It is a community-based agency that works in partnership with the division to provide intervention services that don't, you know, when there's no abuse or neglect occurring in the home.
Gotcha.
So, yes, so, anyone can call that number and be diverted to differential response.
Wonderful. That's great. Thank you for making that distinction between the two. Ms. Crenshaw, you had a comment?
Well, first I want to say hello to the guest again.
Hello.
To everyone. I wanted to chime in on the financial resources that you were talking about earlier. I'm coming strictly from a foster parent point of view.
Okay.
Whereas, Ms. Daniels, you gave a lot of information and great, wonderful information on resources. I'm here in Michigan, and unfortunately the resources for our foster care agencies isn't great at this time due to the current economic climate.
Mm-hmm.
And even prior to they were still struggling with the adoption and foster care system. So I work through a network. It's the Catholic Social Services Network.
Okay.
Where, of course, a lot of the finances come through donations and fundraisers and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Foster parents, and I should say the agency is made up, of course, of the president and then adoption workers, caseworkers, and therapists.
Okay.
And then a lot of positions are very shorthanded in, for lack of better words. So, So the Michigan Social Services Network within mid-Michigan is struggling a little bit. I don't know how the president's stimulus package will come into play with regard to that,
mm-hmm.
but I do know that they're working very shorthanded within our agency. Nevertheless, they do still do a very good job with what we have.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing this for 7 years. The foster care agency that I go through, once again, is the Catholic Social Services Network.
Okay.
It is a wonderful network that also deals with refugees that come to the mid-Michigan area. So it does a lot with the little that it has.
Okay.
But I'm just overwhelmed and very pleased by what you're offering there in the New Jersey area with the resources that you have available.
Yes. We are very fortunate to have... I think we were one of the few remaining states which do not derive their child welfare services largely from private agencies. We are still largely a public agency, which the Division of Youth and Family Services, that is, which is a part of the Department of Children and Families, which is comprised of about 16,000 members of staff. So we provide a wide and comprehensive range of services. Which, as I said, we're very fortunate because we are still largely public. So
mm-hmm.
a lot of our fundings are 4E funds, which every state has 4E funding. Depending on the status of your agency, for example, we have a Catholic Charities, which provides foster care licensing, special treatment homes in New Jersey. But they derive a large part of their budget from the federal funds that the Division of Youth and Family Services receives. And I don't know how that works in Michigan, but I will say this: one of the occurrences which has really changed the direction that the division has gone in is the mobilization amongst child advocate groups within each state to advocate on behalf of the lack of resources. For example, one of our highest risk populations is the adolescents. One state, you know, the aging out issue of children who are no longer attached to families, families have abandoned them, perhaps they were adopted, it was a failed adoption, and therefore they ended back in foster care again. There's been such an outcry, and this is federal funds, but I'm just saying, for example, the point is that mobilizing the National Foster Parent Association, mobilizing your child advocate group, of which every state government has an office of the child advocate. And their job is to advocate or identify the deficits within an agency, to identify the needs of a particular at high risk or at risk population, and to then present their concerns to the government. And then via the law, they pass legislation. A lot of the changes that are occurring in the state of New Jersey are largely the result of the mobilization of these, of the Office of the Child Advocate, of the National Foster Parents Association, which is a national organization, and there's a chapter in every state. And then you can look up adopting.org. There's so many foster parent associations that are national, which have worked, I believe, in collaboration with the Child Rights Initiative in New York to bring about significant changes in the way that we manage and address the needs of families in the state of New Jersey. So I would strongly encourage you and any interested parties that you know to contact your local Office of Child Advocate, to also contact your National Foster Parents Association, because mm-hmm. you are able to mobilize, the larger your constituency, the larger your voice. And I think that's
yes.
one of the pivotal things which led to some significant legislative, and remember, legislation drives funding.
Funding.
The law,
yeah.
the federal laws that create, from based upon federal law, laws or legislations are implemented in local states and entities, which then, in order to receive that federal funding that's attached to that law, that's what needs to be done in every state. Legislations must be implemented that either procure additional 4E funds, procure funds related to child welfare and child protection, and that's done through mobilization.
Yeah.
It's done through mobilization. I cannot understate the importance of mobilizing like parties together to advocate on behalf of the needs of any at-risk populations that you have within your state. And that's what
Very
it took
good.
In the state of New Jersey.
Very good. I'm taking note of all of that. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. I hope I can be of help.
Yeah.
I'll have to say Ms. Crenshaw is modest because she's been given an award for her service as a foster parent. yeah, she's also adopted one of the children who started out as a foster child.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
She continues to keep in touch with, provide mentoring to, and also allow previous foster children to return to her home at times when even their own relatives are unable to accommodate them. So kudos.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, kudos yes. to you and the work that you're doing. And one of the questions that I had for you was, you know, what advice would you suggest to folks who are considering, you know, being a foster parent?
First, you must decide that this is truly what you want to do, because it's not always a walk in the park, so to speak, because you're getting little people that come to your home with all sorts of experiences and behavioral issues on occasion, psychological issues on occasion, social issues on occasion, and more. But having said that, as perhaps the cons, there are some positives too, where you can be a positive force, for lack of better words, in a young child's life. And sometimes you know that can make all the difference in the world. For those of us who've had the experience of having a mentor and how that person may have changed your life, I see myself in that way with a child that comes to my home. But over the years, I've realized that sometimes love is not enough when you're dealing with these children. Love alone, I should say, mm-hmm. is not enough, meaning that they may need some of the children, some therapy to help them get through this phase of coming into the system, because these kids have been pulled from their home in many cases. They're coming to live with a stranger, myself, and in this case, my son. So while we think that may be an okay situation, it may not be for the child coming into the home, because their experiences are different. Their makeup is different, and they've gone through some things that may not allow themselves to trust you right away.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, seeing a child improve over time, his behavior, his letting down his guard, and being accepting and wanting to be accepted, those are the pros for me. And it takes time. You've got to have some patience. You've got to have some love. You've got to have some commitment. And as you were stating, Ms. Daniels, so eloquently, we need support from the agency that we're involved with.
Yes.
We really, really need support because it's a lot of, it's more than a notion because you're having to deal with a lot. And most often children that come into the system have some type of issues. I mean, our own children have issues,
mm-hmm.
but theirs are compounded with, you know, being taken away from their mom or dad. No matter how bad the circumstances were in that home, these children still love their parents. So it's you need patience, you need some love, you need some commitment to say that you're going to stick with this child even through the bad days.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying that on a current note because I have a child in my home who's been here for, I would say, over a month, and he has been a big challenge.
Mm-hmm.
He's 6 years old. He's smart as a whip, but he does have some psychological issues, and we are going through the steps of getting him evaluated and tested.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing, too, a lot of our children, African-American children, are misdiagnosed as being ADHD. And then they're put on medication.
Yes.
You know, oftentimes that's not even really needed. It's really not needed. When you sit down and interact with a child, you may find that it's something totally different. So I don't like when children are misdiagnosed with being ADHD or other psychological issues that may not even actually be there. So it's very interesting. It can be very rewarding. It is very tough on occasion, but I try to remember the goal is to get the child eventually adopted into a stable home, and that's how I look at it.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I had a question. Ms. Daniel, you might be able to answer this. For children who are in foster care, does the services, like, are there counseling services that are available to the children? Like, what's available for, you know, the children? Medical? What usually or normally is included in the types of support services for these children?
Well, I want to go back to something very important that Ms. Crenshaw said, and this is with regards to the over-medication of our youth who present with behaviors that seem to warrant some kind of intervention. Usually, as we know, and there are statistics to support it, many of our children are being over-medicated.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we as parents, as constituency, as constituents, as advocates on behalf of these children must ask the right questions. Now, for example, there's an audit being done in the state of New Jersey for all children that are on resource care because there's a national statistic which is saying, and the APA, the American Psychological Association, would agree with this, any child that's receiving medication for a diagnosed disorder, for example, attention deficit disorder, oppositional defiant behavior, take your pick, there
mm-hmm.
is usually a Not only must they have the regimen of medication, but this regimen must also be accompanied by an applied behavioral intervention, such as individual therapy, that is not only a therapy that's cookie cutter, but that is culturally competent, that meets the child's developmental and emotional stage of development.
Stop. Wait.
Yeah.
So culturally. Let's go to that point. Culturally, say that again.
Culturally competent.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? What it means is our statistics, again, have proven for children, for African-American, children of color, of any culture.
Mm-hmm.
I'll focus on African-Americans because they have the highest statistics in terms of foster care placements at this point, particularly African-American males.
Wow.
The studies have consistently showed that if you do not understand a culture, because there's cultural underpinnings that drive communities, that drive families. If you cannot engage a family at their cultural level, you're not going to have success in engaging them on any other level. You have to understand, and then ask, you know what it's like. You have to try to, as much as you can, empathize and understand as much. And during my graduate training, we were taught, understand as much as you can about that family system. Understand as much as you can about the culture. Understand as much as you can about where that child came from. That child may have grew up, for example, in a largely urban area and was used to a relatively fast pace of life, whereas now he's been placed in a suburban area with a less hectic pace of life, and it had developed something of a – there's a culture around where people live. You know, hood life – excuse me using the term, but life in the hood – is entirely different from life in the suburbs. There's a different pace. There's different measures. There's different ways that people have to conduct themselves in terms of preserving their safety. And this is not to say that it's unsafe in all urban areas. I'm just saying that you have to understand there's a different pace of life in an urban area that is totally different from that of a suburban area. That is not to say one is less, more or less safe. It's to say that you must be in tune with the fact that in every aspect of life, culture drives many activities. There's a culture, there's a gang culture, there's a culture driving it. There's family culture, which transfers language and behaviors and traditions. And many times in therapy, what happens is we're not meeting people where they are. Even if that child is three, what did that three-year-old child experience in his family life with his mother? You know, how was dinner given to him? You know, how was he disciplined? How was she disciplined? Many times in therapy, we're missing unique opportunities to allow the patient to heal him or herself by making assumptions about where that child came from. And that is why medication alone is not working for the thousands and hundreds of thousands of children throughout the continental United States who are in foster care. Medication alone must be accompanied by applied behavioral therapy or some kind of psychotherapy with the goal. Many times our children are getting a cookie-cutter therapy or getting a mentor, but they're not getting therapy that targets the loss, the grief, the missing of the cues that they learned from their mother, who may or may not have been addicted to drugs or may have been engaged in a lifestyle, you know, that he or she, that child, as young as he or she is, became accustomed to. So there's multiple losses, which unless you tune into a child's culture or their understanding of a culture, they can transfer you. Well, my mommy gave us dinner every night at 7 because that's when she came in after whatever. A child can give you so much insight. So medication is not going to be the end all, and that's why it's failing. What foster parents and resource parents must advocate for or are behavioral-specific interventions that teach that child who's learned a certain way of coping, that teaches him or her another way of coping. Because some people are acting out reflexive. They're acting out reflexively. It's a reflex. I've learned to be guarded because in where I grew up, I had to be guarded. There was traffic in and out of my home, for example. I never knew. We never felt safe. There was chaotic. There was domestic violence. So children, at a very young age, because they're so resilient, they learn adaptive behaviors, which after a time become maladaptive when they're no longer needed. This is why, along with medication, Mrs., if it's needed for your child in care, in your care now, you must insist through the case manager or through your resource support people that a therapy be identified. Usually for children that young, it's usually play therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy, which focuses on the behaviors that are maladaptive or which are creating the problem for the child. And play therapy is usually effective because it helps the child to unlearn or to be in a safe, neutral, playful environment where they gain those insights, those aha. Well, why do you break things? Well, I break things because I'm angry. Well, how do you feel after you break it? I feel bad. How does that make you feel? I know I'm going to get in trouble. So certain therapies help kids that are age appropriate, help children to gain insight into why they're doing the things they're doing. Now, the problem is it's costly. It takes time. Mm-hmm. It takes expertise, and it takes someone who's willing to take the time to really get to know your child, where he or she is. So you make a
wonderful, wonderful point, because I have been frustrated on many occasions, but this is the first real explanation that I've got for therapy with younger children,
mm-hmm.
because my age range is from 5 to 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That's the age range for the children that I will accept in my home.
Okay.
And what I notice whenever I get a child that has to go to therapy, all I see is that they're coloring
mm-hmm.
and that they're playing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've never had the explanation that you've given tonight, which I can totally understand. It's more understandable to me now why they will have a child coloring for the entire hour that we're there for therapy.
Okay.
And oftentimes I had not seen any improvement mm-hmm. from these sessions. So that had been discouraging on occasion. But I do appreciate the explanation that you've just given me for that.
And let me go a little further with that, Mrs. Crenshaw. Not only must you have therapy, because let me tell you, therapy, like any other objective or any other strategy, must have a target. And with therapy that for children, there must be specific objectives that are set, specific mm-hmm. outcomes. And these outcomes must be measurable. Most of our resource parents aren't being taught. You have the right to ask the provider, what are the case goals? What is the objective of this? And then there, at the end of all therapies, there needs to be, and it's very important, otherwise the gains that you make are lost over time. Because remember, it's a very double-edged sword thing once a child engages psychotherapy. The therapist is benefiting from making progress with the child, but he or she is also gaining a financial benefit.
Exactly.
And if it's long-term,
exactly.
Long term, even if the child loses the benefit and the practitioner realizes, well, we're not getting any further, is it in his or her fiduciary best interest to discontinue the therapy? It's in the child's best interest, but it may mm-hmm. not be in the provider. So you have the right at every juncture. Typically, most psychotherapies must be assessed every quarter. So every quarter you would have a conference and you'd say, okay, it's been 10 weeks. When you have a case plan and resource parents have to ask for this. When you meet your therapist, you have to say, okay, I understand that you're providing applied behavioral therapy, which is one form of therapy for children with ADHD. I understand you're providing therapy, which is a token economy, which gives my kid, you know, rewards for good behavior, and you know, and that's supposed to reinforce the good behavior. But I need to understand what's the goal of this? What's the objective? How long? Mm-hmm. 10 weeks? What are the measurable? Because again, all therapies, like any other intervention, must be measurable. You have the right mm-hmm. to say, I have not seen any gains in the last 12 weeks. What are the outcomes that you're expecting as a result of this therapy? Because after 6 months, Ms. Crenshaw, if you've had a child
yes.
in therapy and you have not seen any significant change or alteration in that child's behavior, also, if you're not partnering with that therapist so that whatever gains or whatever achievements they're making in therapy, you're able to replicate those changes at home, then it's
yes.
not an effective service. And that's where our children stay on medication, and then they're institutionalized. And they never gain insight, and they're never empowered to make better choices. You have to insist that objective, measurable outcomes are established for any child who's going to be put on medication. It cannot just be, well, Ritalin's going to calm him down. What's the
right.
goal of calming him down? Calming him down so that he can what? So that we can teach him alternative ways of managing his anger, of managing his behaviors, of controlling the impulsivity. If those are not the goals of the medication, then all you're doing is medicating, is drugging a kid.
Right. So if you have a situation, say, where a child has, I'm going to call it an incontinence issue,
mm-hmm.
and the child is of an age where they are old enough to, you know, not go to the bathroom on themselves, but they continue to do it. And let's say you bring this to the attention of the therapist. What I hear you saying is that the therapist should design something to figure out why is this child doing this,
yeah.
Short of a medical issue.
Short of a medical explanation, there's always an emotional issue driving behaviors, because the behavior is usually defies rational logic. A child that, for example, is what we call anuretic, pees on himself, even though the bathroom is maybe within 5 feet of him or her, or pees on himself after getting a discipline. And usually, if the therapist is effective, what they're going to do is they're going to ask you, I want you to begin logging the occasions where the accidents are happening. Tracking when the episodes occur usually gives you insight into some of the triggers that are driving the behavior. Another thing that is often overlooked in therapy, but there are statistics and data to show the correlation. Sometimes these children, many, male and female, have experienced some trauma which has not been addressed. In some cases, particularly with males, one out of five males will be sexually abused. Females,
wow.
One out of three. You have cases where kids are becoming encopredic, which is children who defecate on themselves, or anuretic, where they pee on themselves because it's emotional. Maybe if I do this, no one will touch me. There's so many illogical, childlike explanations that drive those kind of behaviors, but you cannot identify them until you engage that child in understanding why he or she is doing it. How does it make you feel? You know, there's shame attached to that, not having control of your belt. Sometimes it's an emotional, psychological issue. Sometimes it's fear-based. Sometimes it's experiential. Maybe that child grew up in a home. There's so many explanations. You have to track the triggers. There's always a trigger, and there's always what they call a pathology. There's always a pattern to a child or any person's behavior. It's important that in therapy, the therapist be charged with the responsibility of assisting the foster parent or the parent in tracking the triggers, identifying them. Okay, I just hollered at him. He went in the corner and peed. Okay, I didn't give him a cookie. He went in the corner and peed. I did this. Is he expressing his frustration through peeing on himself? Is he expressing his fear, of being harmed by doing this? You know, is it emotional? There's so many reasons, but you must encourage the therapist to help you in exploring the triggers that are driving that behavior. And that's why it's important from the beginning, from the time that we engage an agency, a therapist, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, what's the case plan? How are you going to address this issue? Your assessment shows this. How is this treated? What is the regimen for a child this age? Because the regimen for an adult cannot be the regimen you use for a child. And our children, who are the poorest and come from the minority groups, particularly foster children, oftentimes are given the cookie-cutter institutional approach, whereas their needs are as unique as humans are unique. As unique as the prints on your hands, and yet they're being given services, what I like to call cookie cutter services, because again, because they don't have an advocate, they don't have someone saying, no, I understand this kid should have a case plan. If there's no gains after 6 months, we're gonna have to cut and run and find someone who's gonna take the time to help this kid, or this female. We have to demand. This is where we as representatives of the state, and as foster parents, as agencies, where we have to demand accountability in terms of what's happening to these children who are vulnerable. We have to advocate and demand case plans. We have to demand goals. Therapy should not go on ad infinitum. It can't go on until the kid's 18.
Right.
So we.
I totally agree about the cookie cutter model. Because I feel that over the years, that's what I've been getting, and I don't want to appear that the agency is not doing what they're supposed to be doing. As I mentioned at the top, a lot of it has to do with funding. But I totally agree that it is cookie cutter.
Yeah, but you know what? It is. We have to to demand diversity.
Yes.
When you say diversity, diversity in the practitioners who are in the system providing services.
You have to demand. There are, and we've had to exhaust our own resources. I'm in Camden City, and we have a large Latino population. Well, I would like to, it's wonderful. I love the office that I'm in because the staff represent the population in the city. There's a large number of Spanish-speaking staff persons. We have Spanish-speaking psychologists and psychiatrists. We have a representative staff that meets the needs of the population. And if you are sending an African-American male to, and not to be offensive, if you're sending an African-American male who may or may not have hasn't had positive or otherwise regular encounters with, for example, a Caucasian practitioner, all he's known in his formative years are African-Americans or people of color, and then he's expected to feel safe with a practitioner who is Caucasian, who can't understand what it's like to be an African-American male, who learns at a very young age that the world is a very dangerous and adversarial place for an African-American male. It's very difficult for that practitioner to effectively engage that person without having what we call significant self-awareness, which requires the practitioner to be very open, even if it's painful, about the biases, the prejudices, the stereotypes that often accompany the way African-American males and females are treated, particularly during their formative educational years.
Gotcha.
That is critical that we make sure, you know, people say we had cultural competency training. That's not enough. Mm-hmm. How are you making sure that you have spokespersons or representative groups on your staff to meet the needs of at-risk populations? It simply makes no sense that a predominantly white Caucasian agency is meeting the service needs of a predominantly minority African-American, Latino, or take your pick of any other minority population, and they expect to have effective outcomes. It simply is not going to occur. And that's
right,
what happened with our children.
Right. I understand your point exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really great that the two of you are involved in this arena on, you know, different sides from different perspectives and are doing, you know, the work that that you do. We have a couple of callers on the line. I just wanted to share that you're listening to the International Black Summit Talk Show, and this is the Vision Work segment. We are here every Sunday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and 6:30 on the second and fourth Tuesday. And tonight we're talking about services that are available for parents, foster parenting. We're going to, I'm hoping we'll have some time to do, to share about the mentoring piece.
Okay.
But there is I just want to take a quick check-in right here. A caller at 502-594. Did you have a question or comment? Okay, maybe they're just listening in. 502-594, are you just listening or do you have a comment? Okay, great. And then we had someone at 312-593. Do you have a question or comment for our guest?
No, I'm just listening. But thank you for the information. I actually passed it on to the 502 caller. And she has a daycare, a nursery school. So she's listening. She's listening in.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I appreciate you. Is this Henrietta?
Yes, it is.
How you doing? Thank you, and thank you for passing it on to the 502 caller, Glenn. If you could give me 15 minutes, that'd be great.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. So the other area that I wanted to kind of share with our audience tonight, we have Ms. Daniel, who is intimately familiar with the foster care system and currently now on the other side of the social services system, and Ms. Crenshaw, who is a foster parent and is involved with, you know, providing services to our young people, really empowering them. Two questions. One is, how are, you know, from the perspective of being a foster child and from the perspective of being a foster parent, how do you see the children are empowered by the whole arena? That's one question. And then, Ms. Daniels, if you could take some time and share about what you personally are doing outside of, you know, your professional capacity.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Ms. Crenshaw, I'll defer to you.
I think the kids are empowered when they're able to let their guards down, when they're able to finally get to the point where they can trust me as a foster parent. And then that usually turns into positive moments where their behavior improves at school, where they can now get along with other children that they weren't able to get along with in the beginning. So I know in your declaration you talked about energizing relationships, Claire, at the beginning, and to me that's what represents energizing those relationships for children coming to my home who may be sad, confused, angry, and all those things above. And that if I'm lucky enough, or if we're both lucky enough, we see the changes, positive changes that come through. And it doesn't happen overnight, but when it does happen, it's an energizing moment. And not just for the child, but for me also.
Very true. Do you ever have any of the children who say, you know, say something specifically to you that lets you know that you got through to a particular child, you know?
Well, one child I can think of in particular was having a, I mentioned school a lot, because it seems as though I always get a child or two that has issues in school, where his thing was he didn't finish projects, and he just had a hard time. He just would stop and complain and pout about not finishing projects. And then I got the principal involved at one point with him, and just speaking positive words into his ear, for lack of better words, on a daily basis, about being a finisher, and for lack of better words, or following through with something, and how, you know, how that can be advantageous to you. In a 5-year-old conversation,
right,
putting
right.
in a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old or what have you. And then, long story short, he was able to complete projects. Now, that sounds very minor, but for a child who has social problems or who have issues where they can't finish something for whatever reason, as you said earlier, because they come with so many different issues,
mm-hmm.
that what may seem simple to us is not simple to them, so that when they do have a breakthrough and there is a smile on their face, and he did finish his project, mm-hmm. which was actually a dance at the end of the school year. At the beginning of coming to my home, that I would have never thought that he would actually participate in a school dance and like it. So something minor, but it was something big for him.
Right. And the whole idea of transformation is a really big issue in the Senate, not only for 5-year-olds, but for us as adults, you know,
okay.
being able to have a breakthrough in an area where, you know, like you said, it may seem simple and to the point, but until we're made aware of it or conscious of it, you know, we can't see the other side of it. And then, you know, having someone to interact with you so that you can see, okay, there might be another way to get through the situation and get that breakthrough and transform a behavior is really very significant, not only for children but also for adults. And that's part of the work, you know, that we do at the summit with you know, with adults and in our youth summit, which is, God, that's phenomenal. our the show last week, one of the youth called in. She's probably 26 now, and she started the summit when she was 10. Mm. And, yeah, 10 years old, and she was sharing about how the impact of the work that she did in the summit. She's traveling all over the world. She's actually setting up centers and setting up organizations that support other youth at 26, you know.
Okay.
So, yeah, you never, 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 you know, the impact that we have on the lives of other people and how we empower them, you know, that's phenomenal. That's phenomenal. And when people are doing that kind of work, it's just incredible, you know, to me. I applaud the work that you're doing and that you're, you know, putting yourself out there with the children, because a lot of people wouldn't do that. A lot of people wouldn't open their homes to help other people's children. So
I appreciate it, and it's also my way of giving back too.
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe in that.
Very cool.
I wanted to really salute you, Miss Crenshaw. My mother, as I said, I grew up as a foster child because my mother was killed in 1973, and she had eight children. And we were fortunate to have encountered two families, two adoptive families, the Wiggins and the Daniel family. I am a Daniel, and my other four siblings were adopted by the Wiggins. And we had a mother and father with a very limited education. Education is very important, but they were earnest. They were sincere. They were very committed. They weren't educated, but they were committed to ensuring that we were educated. They had routines established for it. When my parents were kind of Southern, so some of you know, there's some things in hindsight kids look back on. They say, "Ooh," I said, "Mom, I think you were abusive." Yeah, I'm just saying that now, but my mother knows. I've already shared it with her. Foster parents around the world are doing the best that they can do. This is why training and equipping parents to understand the developmental stages of children, the psychological trauma that occurs with loss, is profound for children, and how foster parents need to really be trained to have insight about how traumatic a loss is for a child whose entire world, albeit abusive or traumatic, is their parent, the only parent they've ever known. And
exactly.
So I think it's important that we do more to empower foster and resource parents to understand that. These children are not just bad. Many of them are hurting. They've been through, for lack of a better term, in so many ways, hell, and are recovering from hell. They're recovering from profound trauma. So I would strongly advocate any listeners that are dealing with challenging children, look again. Look again at that behavior. Look again at why that child is reticent, why that child is angry. The only place they feel powerful is when they break something or into them. Now, some children have significant and deep mental health disorders, and it could be organic, it could be chemical, it could be generational, it could be learned, but further assessment is needed before we just conclude that a child is just bad. So I wanted to say that on behalf of children, because I myself grew up feeling like I was such a bad child, but I was an inquisitive kid who simply asked questions like, why? And so we have to really take our time to get to understand that every child's personality is unique. Children are not innately bad. They are inquisitive. They're learning about the world, and they're trying to make sense of it, whether it be good, bad, or indifferent. Mm. And I mentor, as I was saying, to
Before you go into that, there's a caller on line 347 who has a comment or a question before we move on to the next.
Okay, very good.
Mm-hmm. Glenn?
Hi, this is Glenn. I just wanted to say a couple things. One is I have a friend of mine who is white, who adopted a black child in the Florida area. And one of the things that she was confronted by and has finally wrapped her arms around it is that the child actually had multiple personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very difficult process for her to go through. You know, she's very committed to the child, and it took her a while to figure out what was going on, but she was able to now get the right counseling and the right care, so that there's a good outlook for the young person. So I understand, you know, what you're saying is critical, and you know, to be honest, until she let me know about that, I didn't understand the complexities of adoption, and of course, you know, bringing a child into a different, you know, environment that that they were, because the young person is originally from Nevis,
mm-hmm.
In the West Indies,
mm-hmm.
which is where my friend met her.
Mm-hmm.
And so to bring her back to the States, and there was a, you know, she had to get acclimated to that whole way of being and not being in the islands and so on and so forth. So there was a lot going on,
mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely right. It is very, very important for that. The other thing that I just wanted to acknowledge and to really let you know, you said about the cultural piece, and that was one of the things that, of course, she was able to, she has done a lot of work around that, but you're absolutely right. The cultural piece is very important, and being an advocate for that young person when you're dealing with the mental health caregivers,
mm-hmm.
is a vital piece to getting the whole situation worked out. So I just want to, kudos for you for knowing that, understanding that, and bringing it to our attention, because you're absolutely right. It is vital, vital, vital. Thank you.
Exactly.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I'm so appreciative and so honored by the opportunity to share this, because I wanted to say, particularly within the minority group populations, African-American families in particular, Latino families, Indian, and I'm not, you know, just discriminating, but we oftentimes lack the information that's needed to help our children. So it's very important that we become courageous enough, brave enough, and determined enough to do whatever it takes to keep knocking, to not accept an initial DSM, which is when your child gets a psych eval or an assessment, the first thing they get is what they call a DSM 1, 2, 3, 4, axis 1, axis 2, axis 3, 4 diagnosis, the axis 1 being the primary characteristic, being, for example, a child that's bipolar. You cannot mm-hmm. just accept that this is it, because sometimes our kids are being misdiagnosed, or they're getting the standard diagnoses based on behaviors that appear to be. We have the right, even as foster parents, to demand a second assessment, a second opinion, to continue to advocate for our children, to ensure that the solution is not medication alone. It mm-hmm. must be accompanied with behavioral therapies that will help this child to learn adaptive coping skills, because he or she may be confronted with that mental health disorder for the rest of their life. And remember,
right.
these children are being given psychotropic medications which profoundly alter the chemical composition of their brains,
mm-hmm.
particularly at young ages. We have to advocate. We have to write, just as we go to our primary care physicians and we say, what are the long-term effects of taking birth control? What are the long-term effects of this or that? We have to ask, what are the long-term effects of a child taking Ritalin? We've already seen statistically that there are long-term and irrevocable effects that occur with children that are on medications for years and years, and then they become institutionalized, and they're on other medications. Some of our children are on 5 and 6 at age 5 and 6 years old. You have to advocate and demand information. What is the interplay of all of these drugs? We have to, as a community, demand more accountability from the pharmaceutical industries, from the doctors that are prescribing, for example, children that are getting medications, that are on psychotropic medications. A primary care physician cannot prescribe it, but a psychiatrist must be following the medication and its course within that child to ensure that it's properly calibrated, and a primary care physician cannot do that. Only a licensed psychiatrist can continue to prescribe medication. Some people are just getting refills. Medications have to be, a child on medication should be assessed no less than every 30 days to ensure that there are no adverse effects of that medication. If you're not having that occur with children who are, and particularly our foster children, are just getting medicated, if that's not happening, you must insist from your provider, the case manager, or whomever is assisting you in getting that child's needs met, that reassessments are done in a timely, orderly fashion, and that a primary physician, a pediatrician, a family doctor, is not the prescriber of this medication, because all psychotropics must be monitored by a board-certified psychiatrist who is able to also apply behavioral interventions or cognitive behavioral interventions or psychotherapies that are going to address the child's behavior. That's not being done. Your child is simply being drugged.
Ms. Crenshaw, you had a comment?
No, I'm just astounded by all the information and very pleased. I can't say enough how I thank you for this information. Now, I don't know if the rules here apply in Michigan as they do in New Jersey.
The rules are the standard medical practices for any board-certified psychiatrist or any board-certified medical doctor. They know that any mood-altering or psychotropic medication must be monitored no less than 30 days. By law and by ethical case practice on a patient, you cannot allow a patient to take medication ad infinitum, even a person that takes insulin. How often are they assessed by their doctor? At least quarterly, at least monthly. For example, if any of us have parents who are diabetic or have any kinds of long-term chronic illnesses, there's at least monitoring at least once monthly or quarterly. But that's not even mood-altering drugs. That's just insulin. Versus a psychotropic medication, that has to be no less than 30 days, and a pediatrician is not monitoring the cognitive and behavioral needs of a child because he or she is not trained to do that. Only a psychiatrist is trained to meet that need.
Yes, and I must say also that I haven't had many children in my home at all who have needed medication. So therefore, I just didn't know this information existed, but it's...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's very good to know. It's very good to know.
Glenn, you had a comment?
I just wanted to add one thing. The young woman was diagnosed with bipolar and wasn't having a lot of success, and her adoptive mom kept pressing them, and finally she actually ran into somebody who suggested the diagnosis of multiple personalities, and then interviewed her, but it was out of the constant checking of the mother that progress wasn't being made with the medication that prompted her to get to the diagnosis which she now has, because I think that process actually took about a year and a half.
Wow. Yeah, so these are like some really, really valuable points. And I think it's important as we are the guardians of the children, as foster parents, as people who are working in the system, as people who are, working to ensure that our children are protected, this information is valuable. And I hope that, for the people who are listening, they'll be able to go to the websites that you mentioned earlier to get more information. And you gave the information for New Jersey, but I'm sure also they'd be able to find similar information for other states around the country. We have a few minutes left on the show, and I would like to share with the audience about the mentoring project that you were doing. Before we have to sign off here.
I know, and I didn't want to have any interference with my phone, so I actually used a card to to use minutes because I have long distance services through my other cell phone, I have about 1 minute.
Okay.
Yes. I'll just say briefly, I'm willing to help anyone that needs assistance. I mentor women, particularly single mothers or single women in general, about empowerment, about coming into your...
And I believe we have lost her. Okay. So, wow, that's unfortunate. We did, however, go over our time. So for those of you who are still listening, I'd like to thank you for hanging in there with us. This has been a very, very powerful, needed, and I'm sure this topic and conversation impacts quite a few people. So I appreciate our guests, Ms. Crenshaw, and also Ms. Daniel, and everyone else who shared, Glenn, also this evening. If you've enjoyed the conversations today on Vision Works, which is one of many of the shows on the International Black Summit Talk Show Network, you might consider attending our annual summit event. This is the time when folks around the world gather to share their lives, to tune up their listening to what life is giving, and engage in the process of expressing or transforming who they are in the world. The 2009 event, just consider this your personal invitation from me to attend the International Black Summit annual event. It happens the same time each year, which is the first weekend in August. And this year, the summit will be held in London, England, and the dates are July the 30th through August the 2nd. If your calendar is already booked for this year or you'd just like to plan ahead, the 2010 summit will be in Baltimore, Maryland. If you'd like more information about any of our events or to become a member of our community, to donate funds, or just to register for regional activity, you can log into our website, which is www.blacksummit.org. Again, the International Black Summit Talk Show Network airs every Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and also the second and fourth Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. Join us for our next show on Sunday, next Sunday at 8 p.m., which will be Man of the Month. Glenn, would you like to share a little bit about that show?
Certainly. The Man of the Month, we're going to be featuring Mr. Preston King. He is out of New York City. He has an organization that has been around, I believe, for about 25 years called CityWorks. And what it is a not-for-profit umbrella that houses about 45 organizations underneath it that are also using its not-for-profit status. The intention of the organization is really to provide any kind of benefit to the community. And the folks who are involved with it are a lot of folks are from Landmark Education, the people who do the forum, and of course there are people from the International Black Summit that are participating. Preston has been to several of the annual events. So I'm looking forward to a very, very exhilarating show, lots of information, lots of possibility, and a lot of exciting work that's being done in the New York area.
Awesome. Ms. Crenshaw, did you have anything else that you wanted to share?
Other than I know we've talked about the pros and cons of becoming a foster parent, but I encourage any of you who are interested in doing something as such, being a foster parent, that you go and check out the resources that are available, the agencies that are available. Some of the requirements that you may have to go through is a background check. You would also have to do a financial check or a background on that. And then there's classes that are required. I don't know the amount of hours that's required today, but mm-hmm. those are just some of the things that the agency would take you through to become a foster parent.
Clara, there's an 856-359.
Okay. Rosalind, is that you?
That's me. I didn't want to use my cell phone, but if I had known the reception would be great, then I would have stayed on. I'll use it in the first place.
So you got cut off as you were sharing about the mentoring project that you're doing?
Yes, and I apologize for that. Just wanted to mention that we have a vision to see young women, many of whom have experienced significant traumas in their lives of various natures, restored to wholeness. One of the groups that we have, we focus on teenage girls between the ages of 12 and 18. And my organization is called Girls Night Out Incorporated. And we're actually trying to get 501c3 status, nonprofit status, and we will be implementing that within the next year. We really have done everything out of pocket. We've provided retreats, I believe, in education and training for each young girl who has been on a retreat with me. At this point, we've had at least 15 to 20 girls do the retreat. Each girl receives a manual which teaches principles that a princess would employ. How is a princess treated? So we have that retreat. It's usually a two-day or overnight retreat. My expense, because I believe in it. I believe in training. I'm a big Emily Post, who's the Queen of Etiquette fan. So we do social skills training. Then also one project I've taken on, because my heart is really women and children, is I've taken on women, various backgrounds and challenges. I have a dear friend who I met at a conference in Florida, who's now, I like to count as one of my mentees. She's in Georgia. I have a dear friend who I think was scheduled to call in, and she's in Delran, New Jersey. I have another in Lumberton, one in Burlington, another in Woolwich Township, New Jersey. Women who have kind of, I still have been assigned to me, that I've mentored through various stages of healing, self-identity, coming into their sense of their purpose for their life. And it's been rather an organic and informal process, which I have simply made a strong commitment to seeing these women walk into their God-given identity. So that is my personal project. But the main thing I want to focus on at this point are women who are hurting, women who have been experienced trauma, who have not healed from the trauma, but are actually creating patterns in their life where with similar or related traumas continue to recur. Gaining insight is critical to healing. So the women that I'm working with are actually my, if you will, I'm practicing this process with them. And they have been wonderful and open to the tutelage and guidance and support. So I feel very privileged in that regard. And I'm very committed, again, to Girls Night Out Incorporated, and committed to mentoring women and coming into their identity, particularly single women, being that I am also a single mother at this point with a young child. So it's a two-pronged commitment that I have, particularly to African-American females and all girls of all colors. We have Latinos, Indian, all groups of children have been a part of this, even Caucasian. At-risk teenagers in particular are at the heart of my commitment. So that's where I get my most fulfillment. That's where my energy, and that's why I'm such a huge advocate about educating our parents, educating our resource parents, educating those who care about children to know that we have to fight for these youth. We have to fight for them. We have to learn more ourselves so that we can empower others with what we know.
True that. And I just want to, you know, acknowledge you for the work that you are doing in the community, in your job, and just say, you know, keep it going, keep up the energy, keep up the strength, and really, really appreciate you taking the time
to
come on to the show.
What a privilege. Thank you.
Today, it's just been definitely, definitely a pleasure. And Ms. Crenshaw, as always, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for coming on and
thank
for sharing your story and the information about the foster parents. This has been a great, great show.
Yes.
Also want to thank the IBS Talk Show team members and everyone who listened, chatted online, or called in. Really, really, really appreciate it. The International Black Summit is a phenomenal organization, and this talk show network is really a wealth of information, which is really designed to further the conversation of the summit, and we're about empowerment, we're about transformation, and we're really about fulfillment of each person's life purpose and commitments. Mm-hmm. And you both have definitely shared your passion, your vision for the community, and I appreciate you taking the time to share that with us. For our past summit participants, if you have something about how the summit has forwarded your vision, something you're doing in the community, and you'd like to share it on this show, VisionWorks, feel free to send an email to talkshow@blacksummit.org. And you can also listen to this show or any past show 24/7 online at www.blacksummit.org/talkshow. This can be downloaded to your computer, your iPod, your MP3 player, so you can listen to it later or share it with family and friends. Be sure to tune in next week, same date, Sunday, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And my name is Clara Lyons Devon, and I invite you to show up powerfully in your life and share the special gift that God gave only to you. We'll see you in London. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks, Glenn.
You're welcome.
Oops, hello? Am I still on?